Capital Report is underwritten in part by Hopping Green and Sams, which salutes its client CF Industries for its continuing generous contributions to local communities and charitable organizations in Central Florida each year. I'm Susan Stevens of Hopping Green and Sams Law Firm.
The Able Trust, encouraging businesses to hire someone with a disability. More information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of abilities is available on the web at lookatmyability.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. The Fresh from Florida program, supporting Florida's economy by promoting agricultural products grown right here at home, including a variety of seafood harvested by commercial fishermen along Florida's Gulf Coast, on the web at freshfromflorida.com. And Florida Tax Watch, the Florida Council of 100, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plan, proud sponsors of the Prudential Davis Productivity Awards program, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas since 1989. WFSU-FM Tallahassee, and other Florida public radio stations. From the state capitol, the Florida Public Radio Network brings you Capitol Report.
Florida prosecutors release hundreds of documents and audio recordings in the Trayvon Martin case.
And what do you hear Trayvon saying?
Why are you following me for?
Why are you following me for?
Yeah.
Amid a series of negative press, Governor Rick Scott's top aide has chosen to resign. Some say it was the right move.
To seize credit when you become the story as a top staff person, it's probably not good for the governor and his agenda, and he did a noble thing in resigning.
The scores on this year's writing portion of the FCAT were so bad, state officials will now grade on a curve. We hear why. I'm Tramell Gomes, and that's all coming up on Capitol Report. Newly released details about the night Florida teenager Trayvon Martin died at the hands of volunteer neighborhood watchman George Zimmerman is shedding light on what may have happened leading up to the February 26th killing in Sanford. NPR national correspondent Greg Allen has been covering the case and joins the program. So, Greg, what are we learning with the release of this trove of evidence from state prosecutors?
Well, what we got here, Tramell, is a bunch of details. We don't have anything that really totally clears up what happened that night. You get a little information that lends credence to a few different stories. For instance, we get from the Sanford Police Department, from the investigator, Christopher Serino, who had the case until it was given over to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement and Angela Corey, the special prosecutor. Serino had the case before, and on March 13th, he prepared a capias request, a request for the prosecutor to charge George Zimmerman with manslaughter, with a negligent homicide. And in his report, which is very interesting reading, he notes that George Zimmerman had a history of only reporting people as suspicious in the retreat neighborhood who were black males. So it suggests that Serino and at least thought there might be some profiling going on with George Zimmerman, and which is an interesting point. Then he also goes on to say the encounter between George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin was ultimately avoidable by Zimmerman if Zimmerman had remained in his vehicle and awaited the arrival of law enforcement, suggesting he felt that the stand your ground case here would not stop you from charging him. Now, that was on March 13th. The state attorney at that time, Norm Wolfinger in Seminole County, did not act on it. We don't know why not. But a little more than a week later, the governor took the case away from him and gave it to Angela Corey. And, of course, she did charge George Zimmerman in April 11th, for second-degree murder. So that's one of the interesting things that comes right out of it.
And what are some key witnesses that are coming out from this investigation that we know now?
Some of the information that we're seeing in the discovery documents that we released actually does appear to back George Zimmerman's claim of self-defense. And one key witness is a man who is not identified. None of the witnesses are identified in this information. The court redacted their names. His townhome was right next to where the altercation took place. He was inside with his fiancée watching TV. They heard noises. They went out, and he saw much of the fight as it took place on the grass and then on the sidewalk outside of his townhome. And what he says very clearly kind of gives you a sense that, in fact, maybe George Zimmerman was trying to defend himself. Here's some of what he told investigators.
There was a black man with a black hoodie on top of either a white guy, or now that I found out, I think it was a Hispanic guy with a red sweatshirt on the ground yelling out help.
And that witness then goes on to say he told them that he would call 911 if they didn't stop. He turned around, went inside to call 911. As he ran up the stairs, he heard what he later determined to be a gunshot. He looked out and saw the person who had been on top, who now we believe to be Trayvon Martin, lying on the ground. And as we know, he was dead at that point. So there's that witness is key. The lawyer for George Zimmerman, Mark O'Mara, says we don't take anything out of context here. All these little individual pieces that are coming out of the discovery should not be taken too seriously. We'll look at the whole case, and that's how we'll make it. So he's not making any comments one way or the other on what we've seen so far.
So, Greg, I understand there is another key witness, Trayvon Martin's girlfriend, who was speaking to him minutes before he died. What does she add to the case?
Right. We've heard about her. We knew that she, Benjamin Crump, the attorney who's representing Trayvon's family, had play audio of this witness that we didn't know about for some time until he played this audio of this witness. This is a woman who identified herself in a couple of interviews as Trayvon's girlfriend. Someone, she said she knew him from when they were little kids. He always came by the house. He said he was a sweet boy, sweet young man who wouldn't fight, and that was his problem. One of the things she said, she'd been on the phone with him on and off throughout that entire day, including when he went to the 7-Eleven. She said when he came back from the 7-Eleven, he put his hoodie up because it was raining outside. And they talked about that on his way back. And then he told her that he saw someone watching him at a car, someone he thought was creepy. And that was, we know to be George Zimmerman. She told Trayvon to just run home. At that point, she says Trayvon did start running home. She says she believes that Zimmerman got out of his car and pursued Trayvon. After a while, Trayvon Martin stopped running. She said, keep running. He said, I'm too tired, but the other guy's tired too. Eventually, Zimmerman caught up, and that's when there's a confrontation. Here's a little bit of what that woman, that Trayvon Martin's girlfriend, had to say to Assistant State Prosecutor Bernie De La Rionda.
Okay, and what do you hear Trayvon saying?
Why are you following me for?
Why are you following me for?
Yeah.
And then what happened?
I hear this old man, like an old man.
Okay.
Say, what are you doing around here?
Okay, so you definitely could tell another voice that was not Trayvon.
Yeah.
And you heard this other voice say what?
Yeah. What are you doing around here?
What are you doing around here? Okay.
After that conversation, she says that she says from Trayvon's voice, she could tell that Trayvon was scared, and she was yelling into the phone, Trayvon, what's going on? What's going on? But he didn't answer. That was the last she heard from Trayvon, but the phone remained open. The phone line remained open. At one point, she heard some kind of bumping, and she heard kind of struggling in the grass, and she knew there was something going on, and then the phone went dead. And then we know shortly after that is when George Zimmerman shot and killed Trayvon Martin.
Now, Greg, this case has sparked a number of debates about race and gun laws, particularly here in Florida. What impact will this have from what you can see so far, and what changes are coming about?
Well, you know, it's already had a significant impact. I mean, as you know, we've had Stand Your Ground. That law here was pioneered here in Florida. It spread to some other states around the country. And although state attorneys and prosecutors and judges have been upset about it, it hasn't really gotten much attention. That all changed with the Trayvon Martin shooting. And now, of course, we have this task force from the governor. They had their first meeting recently. And the task force, I think, looks like it's got a lot of people on there who will have strong opinions about this and would like to make some changes. They're going to start taking testimony next month. They'll continue through until the fall and presumably make some kind of recommendations to the legislature. So I think that one would have to assume at this point we're going to see some changes to Stand Your Ground. If we don't, I think there might be a price to pay. So that'll be interesting to watch through the fall, but I think we'll see some changes in the Stand Your Ground law.
That's NPR's national correspondent Greg Allen speaking to us from Miami. Governor Rick Scott will soon say goodbye to his current chief of staff and welcome his third one since his 16-month term began. As Sasha Cordner reports, Steve McNamara announced his resignation after media reports scrutinized some of the contracts he handled, as well as how he did his job.
A flood of allegations emerged from several news outlets in recent weeks, but that did not faze Governor Rick Scott when he was asked about his current chief of staff, Steve McNamara. Scott came to his defense just days before McNamara said he was stepping down.
We're getting a lot of good things done. We're getting jobs are coming back. Got $1 billion in education. We got PIP done. And now you got being mean to my chief of staff.
Some media reports outline McNamara's clashes with agency heads who have since resigned. That included former Department of Economic Opportunity head Doug Darling and former Florida Department of Management Services Secretary Jack Miles. But Scott says McNamara was just doing his job.
I talk to agency heads. I spend as much time as I can, but you know, Steve's the chief of staff. That's his job, is to work with agency heads, and I think he's done a great job.
Other reports claim McNamara handed out contracts to friends and associates, like a no-bid contract to a friend who now leads a task force rooting out government waste. That contract was worth $360,000. And just a couple days before his resignation, an ethics complaint was filed against McNamara by a man in Clearwater. The complaint claimed McNamara used state employees to help him pursue a position as a college president in Montana. Finally, McNamara met with the governor over the weekend of May 12th and announced he'll be resigning effective July 1st.
And Stephen McNamara, the chief of staff of Florida Governor Rick Scott, has resigned amid allegations that he steered lucrative state contracts to his friends and relatives. The people most upset about his resignation? His friends and relatives. Yeah, they're screwed.
To Steve's credit, when you become the story as a top staff person, it's probably not good for the governor or his agenda, and he did a noble thing in resigning.
As a former top staffer for former Governor Lawton Childs, Ron Sack says he knows McNamara has a thick enough skin to take a joke from Jay Leno, even though the jab may have been a little inaccurate as the accusations only dealt with friends, not relatives. Sack says McNamara has done a lot for the governor, including getting Scott to dress more informally and making his office more open to the press. He says that's what strikes him as odd about the media reports.
What's been unusual about the press coverage is the very guy who improved their access to the governor, now the target of some journalists' basically pointed stories, and there's never been any hint that Steve has done anything illegal, unethical, outside of the rules. There's never been any hint that he's profited by even $1. By decisions he's made, and I think a lot of it has been unfair.
McNamara will now be replaced by Adam Hollingsworth, who comes highly recommended by Lenny Curry, the chairman of the Republican Party of Florida. He's known Hollingsworth for several years and says Hollingsworth is a good choice.
Well, he's got relationships and experience with the legislature. He's also chief of staff for Mayor John Payton here in Jacksonville. And he's also got business experience, so he's got a good diverse background with experience specifically as a chief of staff. So I think he's a problem solver. He's the perfect fit.
And Hollingsworth is no stranger to Scott. He assisted the governor in his gubernatorial campaign as an advisor. Hollingsworth says he's looking forward to working with the governor again.
The governor ran on a very focused platform that was to create 700,000 jobs over the next 7 years, and he's well on his way to doing that. So the team is already clear about the agenda and clear on the principles that the governor uses to make decisions, and I'll certainly look forward to being a part of helping to execute on those principles and that agenda that he's already established.
Hollingsworth is expected to start his new job as chief of staff on July 1st. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, falling scores on this year's FCAT writing test have state officials grading on a curve.
Now, I wouldn't describe it as eating crow. I'd describe it as a process. This in no way was lowering standards as much as calibrating for some changes that needed to take place.
Florida's property insurer is looking to boost its rates by more than 10%.
What we're trying to do is read the tea leaves from last year's leftovers to give us some type of compass as to what happens if we implement certain ideas.
And food trucks become Florida's fastest growing category of food service business.
It also is awesome because the patrons can talk to us on Facebook and tell us what they want to have. So if they come up with something that's kind of crazy and interesting and different, we'll make it.
The scores on this year's state writing test were so bad that state education officials voted to grade the test on a curve. The move comes after about 75% of students who took the test failed it. And as Lynn Hatter reports, those failing grades coupled with the State Board of Education's decision to lower the passing score on the test have observers once again questioning the value of standardized testing.
This year, the state placed greater emphasis on grammar, punctuation, and spelling, basic components of what most people would consider writing. But that extra focus is part of what tanked this year's writing grades. Rose Collins, a grandparent of a student in Orange County, says she can't figure out what the fuss is about.
Unless I'm oversimplifying what I'm hearing, that basically the changes are they're just paying attention to spelling, punctuation, and grammar. And to me, I'm just thinking as a comment that when I went to school, that's was basic function of learning to write in a sentence, so it really shouldn't be an issue for them to be able to complete that anyway.
But apparently it is that hard, because 70% of students who took this year's writing test failed it. Education officials say prior to this year's focus on basic writing conventions, like spelling and grammar, the state had taken a more holistic approach to writing, which meant focusing more on the ideas rather than the execution. Sabrina M. Allen has been teaching for about about 15 years in the Big Bend.
And, you know, you use a holistic approach when you don't know how to teach writing. It's subjective.
On the old writing test, students were expected to produce something that looked like a rough draft, but the new test requires a more polished look. Prior to the state raising the bar on the test, about 80% of kids were passing it. The State Board of Education held an emergency conference call to lower the passing score on the exam from a 4 to a 3. But even that move caught flack from some who viewed the change as a retreat from higher standards. But State Education Commissioner Gerard Robinson says the lowering of the passing score is not a sign that the state is backing down.
I wouldn't describe it as eating crow. I would describe it as a process. We took a look at the fact that there was some lack of communication on our part to really prepare teachers and educators for the kind of impact that it would have. And I see this today as an action that favors an accountability system that's strong, but at the same time identifies that holding students to higher standards is important. This in no way was lowering standards as much as calibrating for some changes that needed to take place.
The fall off in the scores also has sparked a blame game. Many teachers complain the changes were never communicated well from the state. Others wonder what the teachers were teaching if it wasn't grammar, punctuation, and spelling. Again, Commissioner Robinson.
There was a point in American curriculum history where grammar was a part of the curriculum. For a host of reasons, we moved from grammar to English language arts or learning, for a whole set of reasons. Many adults say that they're better writers now than many of our children because of the shift from grammar.
It used to be that grammar was taught by itself, but now it's part of a wider language arts curriculum. Other concerns over this year's FCAT writing test include the amount of time students were given to complete it. Many people said the 45 minutes allocated wasn't enough time to complete a rough draft and a finished product. Shortly after the release of the preliminary writing scores, opponents to standardized testing were already highlighting the drop-off as an example of why such tests don't work. Democratic State Representative Ron Saunders says these results should be a wake-up call to parents and education officials.
And I think as a parent, I'd be very concerned that my kid's not getting a good education. I want him to learn more than just how to take a test. I want him to learn all the basic skills he's going to need to be a good college student and a good member of society. So I think that misuse of the FCAT is a serious problem for all of us that are parents and all those that care about our education system in the state of Florida.
The Florida Department of Education is launching an investigation into what went wrong with this year's FCAT writing test, and it says that school districts won't be penalized for the drop in writing scores. Florida has been widely credited with boosting student achievement at the K-12 level, but despite that success, colleges and universities continue to complain that students aren't prepared for the coursework in higher education. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
You're listening to Capitol Report on the Florida Public Radio Network. I'm Tramell Gomes. Lawmakers passed a measure in 2009 imposing a 10% rate cap on citizens' property insurance premiums. But Regan McCarthy reports the company is now saying it doesn't think the caps apply to new policyholders.
State-run Citizens Property Insurance is the biggest property insurer in the state with more than 1 million policies, but it's been directed by the governor to get smaller in order to decrease its competition with private market insurers. That's the motivation behind Citizens' plan to increase rates for new policyholders above the 10% cap set by the legislature. The goal is to start getting more actuarially sound, but there are some questions about how the insurer will get there.
So what we're trying to do is read the tea leaves from last year's leftovers to give us some type of compass as to what happens if we implement certain ideas that we are testing.
That's John Rollins, a member of the Citizens Board of Governors. Rollins says the group is a long way from making a decision that will affect ratepayers' pocketbooks, and he says the decisions that are made will be made methodically and with oversight from the Office of Insurance Regulation.
The statute gives OIR complete and final authority over actually establishing citizens' rates.
Rollins says it's an unshakable check and balance, and he adds that he wouldn't support a move that led to what he calls a massive rate increase, something he says some media outlets have been saying could happen.
From where I sit, I'm only one board member, of course, but I do have some expertise in rate issues, and for my money, I'm willing to say that I won't support anyone's rate increasing by some of these percentages I've seen in the media. To be clear, I'm not going to support a 90% rate increase in a single year on a single policy if that's what ends up happening and that's what would be put on the street as a result of our decision. It's simply not going to happen.
And board member Carlos Lacasa agrees the board will have to move forward carefully. He says there are some people who will have a hard time finding any property insurer other than Citizens. And he adds it's important to remember that there are people behind the policies the board is discussing.
There are real people on the receiving end of this, and I want to understand who those people are and where they live.
There's also some question about whether the Citizens Board can legally raise the rates for new policyholders above the 10% cap. Chief Financial Officer Jeff Atwater sent a letter to the board voicing his concerns about the proposed move. He says when he voted on the measure in 2009, he didn't think the intent was to allow uncapped rates for new policyholders. But Citizens President Tom Grady maintains that what the insurer is proposing is legal.
Legally, can we do that? And we think we can, and I won't take the time of the committee to get into the details, but we have done the research and we have checked the legislative intent of the law.
Citizens board members say they'll keep looking into their options. The subject is expected to come up for a full board discussion at their upcoming June meeting. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
We're counting down to when all eyes will be on Florida for the Republican National Convention in August. Presumptive GOP presidential candidate Mitt Romney continued his campaign with a swing through Florida this week. He spoke to supporters in Jacksonville on Thursday. Maggie Seppi from member station WJCT prepared this report.
Thank you. Romney held a fundraiser in Jacksonville, then followed it with a rally for supporters at a restaurant Thursday. He responded to the warm welcome from the crowd by expressing his fondness for the Sunshine State, and specifically, Jacksonville.
You know, my wife, I wish she were here today, Anne is campaigning in Texas, Louisiana. She has said someday, who knows, we might move to Florida, you never know, someday, you know, way down the road. And we had the chance during the primaries to be able to go all over the country and see a lot of places, and she said, you know what? If we're going to move one place, I love Jacksonville, Florida. So she knows a good thing when she sees it.
During a session with reporters, Romney chastised President Barack Obama for what he called a campaign of character assassination. Romney was responding to a recent campaign ad that questioned his time at the helm of Bain Capital.
My effort at Bain Capital, as you know, was in every case designed to try and make the enterprises we invested in more successful, to grow them. There's this fiction that some have that somehow you can be highly successful by stripping assets from enterprise and walking away with lots of money and killing the enterprise. There may be some people who know how to do that. I sure don't.
The ad pointed out that Bain forced the closure of a Missouri mill years ago, sending workers into unemployment, but allowing the company to clear millions of dollars in the transaction. Also during his stop in Jacksonville, Romney criticized a proposed effort by a conservative super PAC to unleash a media campaign linking President Barack Obama to the Reverend Jeremiah Wright. His comments were in response to a New York Times article that detailed plans by the Republican super PAC, the Ending Spending Action Fund, to link President Obama to Wright, who has made racially charged comments on the pulpit. Romney, however, says he wants to keep the conversation on other issues.
I hope that our campaigns can respectively be about the future and about issues and about a vision for America. I've been disappointed in the president's campaign to date, which is focused on character assassination. I just think that we're wiser to talk about the issues of the day, what we do to get America working again.
Romney says he wants to focus on a positive campaign that will highlight his business experience and his ideas on how to stimulate job growth. Conservative billionaire Joe Ricketts, who considered funding the campaign, later said he had decided not to do so. Romney concluded his speech by letting Floridians know just how important this state is to his campaign.
But Florida is certainly a state I want to win, a state which George W. Bush won, and given the fact it's voted Republican in the past as well as Democrat, this is a state that'll be a battleground state. Florida is a state that I'm counting on to be successful in.
Florida is one of about a dozen swing states that are expected to determine the winner of the White House this November. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Maggie Seppi.
Finally, not long ago, food trucks were few and far between in Florida. Now, as Tom Flanagan reports, the kitchens on wheels are showing up all over the state, and their numbers are growing.
The scene is the parking lot of a state government office complex in Tallahassee. There are more than a dozen food trucks set up in one corner of the lot, their onboard electrical generators roaring. Hungry customers are lining up at the trucks, most of which offer fare above and beyond the traditional staples of hamburgers and hot dogs. The Great American Sandwich Station truck is owned by Kenny Durkin, who's also the head chef.
Well, one of our most popular would be the Greek steak sandwich. It's kind of like a gyro steak sandwich combination.
with all the great Greek flavor and the amazing flavor of the ribeye cheesesteak.
Alicia Kilman takes customer orders at the window and also does kitchen work as the truck makes its rounds.
We go to different locations that do different types of events. You know, sometimes we get a big crowd of people, sometimes we don't. But either way, we have a lot of fun. And, you know, like Kenny said, we have great food here. I really enjoy working here.
Brittany Smoke likes her job, too. The truck she works in is operated by Moby, a local brick-and-mortar restaurant specializing in contemporary Asian cuisine.
Well, the great thing about owning a food truck, as our owner Viet would tell you, is that he can make whatever he really is passionate about making, whatever he feels like making that day, essentially. It also is awesome because the patrons can talk to us on Facebook and tell us what they want to have. So if they come up with something that's kind of crazy and interesting and different, we'll make it.
That creative license even extends to the humbled grilled cheese sandwich as cranked out by a truck named Sir Cheesy. It was attracting a huge crowd, and we caught up with one customer as he walked from the truck with his order. He declined to give his name.
You just stood in line to get a grilled cheese sandwich.
Uh-huh.
Why did you do that?
Well, it looked different from the others. It was an attractive booth as well, but the food looked very attractive. I like cheese, so there you go.
There was another happy customer chowing down nearby, Florida Department of Business and Professional Regulation Secretary Ken Lawson.
Well, right now I just got a chicken sandwich with big pieces of chicken that's delicious with some sauce and some bread. I mean, I'm happy, all right? But more importantly, you know, this food represents what these food trucks are doing in the community.
The main thing they're doing, of course, is bringing meals and snacks to where the customers are. During the recession, many organizations shrank in size. That often shortened worker lunch breaks, forcing them to stick close to the work site. Food trucks were a welcome alternative to brown bagging. The growing demand for that service has prompted more people to get into the food truck business. Secretary Lawson says that makes mobile vendor licenses the fastest growing category of food service licenses his department now issues.
I think we got around like 3,000 or so food trucks in the state of Florida, and it's grown over the last several years. But the main thing is, want people to know that if a food truck's license, it's safe, all right? They can check out that truck's license on our website, or if they go to a truck, they'll have to display their license, and they can ask for a copy of that last inspection to see how they rate it out.
One more thing Lawson wants people to know. Before they start their own food truck or even hot dog cart business, they need to get up with his office to make sure that business is properly licensed. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Tom Flanagan.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Sasha Cordner, Tom Flanagan, Lynn Hatter, and Regan McCarthy. Thanks also to the contributing stations along the Florida Public Radio Network. Ken Smith provided technical assistance for Capitol Report, and I'm Tramell Gomes, inviting you to join us next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809, extension 358. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org.
Capitol Report is underwritten in part by Hopping Green and Sam's, which salutes its client CF Industries for its continuing generous contributions to local communities and charitable organizations in Central Florida each year. I'm Susan Stevens of Hopping Green and Sam's Law Firm.
The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, because people want to work. The Fresh from Florida program, supporting Florida's economy by promoting agricultural products grown right here at home, including a variety of seafood harvested by commercial fishermen along Florida's Gulf Coast. On the web at freshfromflorida.com. And Florida Tax Watch, the Florida Council of 100, the Florida Lottery, and AvMed Health Plan, proud sponsors of the Prudential Davis Productivity Awards program, recognizing and rewarding Florida's innovative state employees for their cost-saving ideas since 1989. WFSU-FM Tallahassee, and other Florida public radio stations. This is the Florida Public Radio Network.